They thought I couldn't hear them. But I've upgraded, made sure my audio is top of the line. It's got to be out here. At this range, I could hear the chirp of their hard drives and the whine of their backup batteries charging. I could hear them creeping closer, using the time I was giving them to set up a crossfire. They were probably hoping to toss in an EMP nade, then jump me on reboot. It was likely the best move they had. No reason to step into the line of fire. After all, they had me cornered, right? I slipped quietly off the desk, pulse rifle still trained on the only way in, easing the metal of my feet onto the cement floor, letting my servos go loose and limp to muffle any sound. Then I crept, slow and quiet, into the deep black of the back of the store. I popped on my low-light sensors, but they only got me to the back of the storefront. Where I needed to go next was the stockroom. Pitch black and seamless, entirely cut off from the outside world. Behind me, in the halls, I could hear the tintinnabulate of metal feet hot on my heels. They weren't trying to hide their footfalls. They wanted me twitchy, trigger-happy. They wanted me to unload the rifle, leaving me empty-handed and alone. I slipped through the door at the very back of the store and switched on the LEDs in my sockets. I hated using them. They were a dead giveaway. But it was too dark for night vision, and thermal imaging wasn't going to be able to discern what I was looking for. The stockroom was a mess of wrappers, tin cans, and petrified shit. Piss stains on the walls of one corner, makeshift bedding crumpled up in another. But in the very back, in the farthermost corner of the room, behind toppled shelving, were the remains of Vic. Vic was a spot on the wall. A big spot, to be sure. Big and brown and drippy along the edges. But a spot nonetheless. The white cinder block walls upon which he was painted were chipped and battered, with flecks torn out, shards of bone still embedded in places. Whatever bomb or grenade this poor, brave bastard had held in his hands all but vaporized him on detonation, shattering the innards of the two bots closest to him and tossing four others around like rag dolls. Vic had stood his ground. He wasn't going to be taken alive. Instead, he took them all with him. Seven with one blow. Like the old fairy tale, but without the happy ending. As, well, though he was the victor, he was also one of the seven. Vic was now a blood splatter that had dried brown and symmetrical right above the nice bot-size hole the blast had blown out in the floor beneath him. I had covered it up ages ago with bedding and scrap, and barred the door in the stockroom below from the inside. The bedding was exactly as I'd left it, identical to the snapshot stored in my memory. No one had been here. No one had disturbed it. Not once in the decade since I found it. Finally, something was going my way. I slung the rifle over my shoulder, pushed aside the blasted metal and moldy blankets, and slid down through the hole, dangling myself into the room below. The room was pitch black, the light of my LEDs probably the first it had seen in years. The door was held in place by a 4-foot-long piece of rebar, slotted into two makeshift hooks I'd drilled into either side of the door. The refuse I'd laid in the crack still remained, my makeshift seal unbroken. The advantage was still mine. I had caught my break, now to use it to its fullest. It was time to go on the offensive. I was going to have to kill each and every one of these motherfuckers. One by one. I slid out the rebar, set it quietly aside, and turned the handle as slowly and silently as I could. The door jerked open with only the faintest sound, not loud enough to register in the intimidating din the poachers were making. I turned off my LEDs, unslung the rifle from my shoulder, and made my way out into the store. It was an old-fashioned, southern-fried, country-kitsch, plus-size clothing store, its wares long since burned to ash on their hangers, its racks buried 6 inches deep in their cinders. I slipped through, hunched low, keeping out of the eyeline of the floor above. I could hear them, one floor up, moving in for what they thought was the kill. Peeking around a corner, I caught sight of one of the poachers here on the second story with me, his rifle trained up the escalator in case I made it past Mercer and his buddy. It was a late-model Omnibot, the jack-of-all-trades, master-of-none model ever popular with the wealthy types, who wanted a bot but had no particular use for one. This one was a Mark V from the looks of it. Shiny, polished chrome from head to toe. But you never could tell. Mark IVs liked to mod themselves out to look like the Mark Vs. And sometimes you couldn't tell which was which, until you cracked them open and got a gander at their architecture. The difference between the 4 and 5 was mildly cosmetic on the outside, but radically different within. The 5s were faster, smarter, but more disposable. Their parts wore out twice as fast. Hence all of the parts lying around, allowing 4s to pass themselves off as 5s. I crept, ever so quietly, to a perfectly concealed vantage point, behind a twisted piece of blasted metal, resting my gun barrel on the edge of the blown-out window. Now all I had to do was wait. If he looked my way, I'd fire. If he didn't, I'd wait for just the right moment.
"One last chance, Brittle," called Mercer upstairs. "You're winking out any minute now. I'll let you do it on your own terms. All you gotta do is just shut down."
I didn't call back.
"All right," he said. "Can't say I didn't play nice."
"How do you know she didn't shut down?" whispered the other.
"Because that just ain't Brittle."
Then came the clanking staccato of a grenade bouncing around in the rubble above. 3, 2, 1. "Wham!" hummed the nade as the pulse rifle leapt in my hand, barely audible above the noise. I'd timed it just right. As every bit of circuitry within 25 feet of ground zero was sizzling and popping above me, Mercer's out-of-town poacher buddy was spinning toward the railing, his head blown clean off his neck, plastic and metal bits showering with a tinkling clatter to the floor below. Shit. No, 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 no. The shot was perfect. The bot's reaction wasn't. He pinwheeled, doubled over the railing, threatening to topple end over end. He was a top-heavy bot to begin with. I'd hoped to keep his death a secret for a few minutes more, buying me enough time to get the drop on the remaining poachers. But now I had only seconds to relocate. Above me, Mercer called out once more.
"Clear!"
They were rushing the sniper nest. I had only milliseconds before they realized I wasn't there. For a moment, the bot seemed to hang in the air, teetering back and forth, threatening to go over the side, but lacking the nerve to actually do so. And then he did. End over end he went, hurtling toward the first floor before his ringing demise echoed through the marble and stainless steel expanse. But by then, I was already padding down the promenade toward the mall's east wing.
"Riley?" the other poacher called out. "What was that?"
Silence.
"Riley!" he called again.
Mercer barked out from the back of the storefront.
"She's gone."
"What?"
"She ain't here."
"Riley!"
"Riley's dead, you idiot."
Then he got loud again, volume cranked to max.
"Brittle, you ain't getting out of here. Not walking anyhow. Don't make me damage parts I can use later. You ain't walking out of here, you hear me?"
I did, but I wasn't going to dignify him with a response. If only one of us was walking out of here, I damn sure wasn't going to give him an edge. And if it wasn't going to be me, well then, I was going to take a page from Vic's book. Either I was walking out of here, or none of us was. And for that, I needed to get to the East Wing.
"Brittle,"
he called out again. I gave him nothing and let him choke on it. Sundown was fast approaching, which meant I was getting closer to the cover of night. Mercer was fitted for a night chase. Night sight mods, IR, echolocation. But even all that gear couldn't spot the dust of a buggy from a couple miles out in the dark. He was running out of time, which meant he was no doubt getting desperate. And if he was desperate, he might make a mistake or two. And that's what I needed. He'd already made one mistake. Another could set me free. A third might even earn me a clean shot at him. "That way," he boomed in my direction. He was right. Must have had hearing mods every bit as good as mine, if not better. Probably could hear each nearly silent step I took. I could hear the running footsteps behind me, echoing hollow through the empty like a wrench banging against pipe. They were still one floor up, not even trying to hide their pursuit. I was steps away from turning into the east wing when I heard the clangor of Mercer's companion whipping around the railing from the third floor and flipping down to land like a cat on the second. I'd been right. It was military grade, a field-specced simulacrum model designed to fight alongside special forces. Sniper mods, agility and speed enhancements, full sensor array. A sick amount of gear on a titanium body, built to sustain heavy fire, while its unit either advanced to engage or retreated to evac. A sonar radar package in its chest, in the event its reinforced optics suffered damage or immersion in total darkness. Those things were among the toughest bastards around. And this one was scrambling to his feet, steadying his rifle, ready to glaze me with a shock of EMP. It would take a tank shell to smash apart that torso. Blowing its head off wasn't going to save my life either. I had very few options left. The pulse rifle jumped in my hand, the bolt screaming out through the dim hallway. The blast struck true, his rifle shattering to pieces in his hand, ammo exploding, sparks sizzling against his titanium frame. Undeterred, he charged headlong at me without hesitation. I fired again from the hip, loosed a pulse toward the ground, the shot clipping his kneecap right in the joint. He spun on his toe, his leg giving out from under him. I slipped to the side with a half-spin of my own, his heavy body, almost four times heavier than my own, sailing past me, unable to regain his footing so quickly. The shot wouldn't cripple him for long. Behind me, glass shattered, metal buckling, bending under the weight of the bot. I could hear him struggle to his feet, the servos in his knee already compensating, his gyro readjusting to set him upright, allowing him to run normally, despite the damage. But by the time he was on his feet, I had made it. The east wing. Just a few more paces, I kept repeating to myself. Just a few more paces. Ahead of me were dilapidated toy stores, an empty cheese shop, and a hollowed-out hole that had been hit by so much fire that its wares and purpose were now entirely unrecognizable. It was the safest place in all the mall at this moment. For me, at least. I could hear him tearing after me, could hear his footfalls clattering, could hear his servos and gears whirring into place to tackle me from behind. I turned, raised my pulse rifle, prayed that it had at least one more shot in it. He rounded the corner. His feet skidded across the marble, trying to get enough grip to slow his momentum. He slipped a bit, catching himself on the railing before coming to a complete stop. He looked up, eyeing my gun. We traded glances in silence. Him waiting for me to shoot. Me waiting to see what, exactly, he intended to do next.
"What are you going to do with that?" he asked.
"Well, I was thinking about shooting you."
"You tried that already."
"I did," I said, nodding.
"How'd that work out for you?"
"Got me where I needed to be."
"Is there even any ammo left in that thing?"
"I was just fixing to find out."
"Well, what are you waiting for?"
"Same thing you are," I said.
"Mercer."
He raised a clenched fist in the air and let out a stern chirp.
"Hold back," he called out. "Your mark's up to something."
am I?
You are, he said, trying to puzzle it out. He eyed me up and down, sizing me up.
Why don't you just come and get me?
You know, just take another step or two forward. He looked down at the ground, trying to see what he'd missed. Then he looked back up at me. If he could smile, which military-grade bots could not, he would have. You could just hear it dripping in his voice. He was so proud of himself.
You're bluffing. You've got nothing.
Not down there, I don't. I popped my Wi-Fi and let out a 4.5 megahertz trill. I doubt the bot was listening. Most bots were smart enough not to have their Wi-Fi connection open unless they were specifically scanning for OWIs. And even then, they didn't listen in on a bevy of bands, only the high-chatter ones. What he no doubt did hear, however, was the sound of the thermite drilled into the concrete and the marble of the massive walkway one level above us. Each stick of it connected to a Wi-Fi receiver set to, you guessed it, 4.5 megahertz. The thermite slagged the stone around it instantly. He had just over a second to take in, respond, and avoid several tons of solid cement and rock. He barely had time to flinch before it hit him. There would be no parts left to salvage, no light left in his eyes, titanium be damned. Now all he was a military-grade pancake. Nothing more. Part of me wished I'd managed to wait for Mercer, and hadn't tipped my hand when I did. But Mercer was full of good parts. Parts that would work in me. Maybe flattened under a sheet of rubble wasn't the best way to see him go.
Charlie, called Mercer.
No answer.
Charlie Bravo.
Nope, I called back. It's just you and me, Mercer.
It is just you and me, right?
Well, I don't know, Britt.
Maybe it is, maybe it ain't.
You're running out of friends.
Ain't that always the way of it?
I suppose it is.
So how are we going to do this?
He called out, still out of sight. I was thinking maybe I'd shoot you.
Not with that gun, you're not.
Still trying to get in my head about that?
Yeah, he said. I am.
Well, if there aren't any shots left in this thing, there's no reason for you to stay hidden. Why don't you come on out and shoot me face to face?
Maybe because I'm not sure how many more of those booby traps you've got in here.
I'm pretty sure that was the last one.
Why don't I believe you?
Same reason I don't believe you about this gun, I said.
Go ahead and pull the trigger. Find out for yourself.
I'll make you a deal. I'll pull this trigger when you step out, and we'll both find out who's full of shit.
That sure sounds like an awful plan.
I love an awful plan.
So count of three, then?
He asked. Count of three, I said. I wasn't sure exactly where he was, but by triangulating his voice, I had a pretty good idea. I imagined he was likely to pop out from behind his cover on the count of two. I didn't plan on being around for that.
One, he said.
I ran.
Two.
There were stairs ahead that spiraled down straight to another set of doors. I bolted for those. He never said three. A shot rang out. Hit me square in the back. I heard my backplate fly off, the sound of wires popping and sizzling. Fuck. The asshole had just shot my battery case. Killed my battery. My system flickered on and off for a millisecond as I switched over to my backup. There was no telling how much damage I'd just taken, whether the battery was fried or my connection to it was merely severed. That I'd have to have looked at. But for now, I was running on my reserve battery, which wasn't meant for long-term use. Of all the hits I could have taken, though, that was the one I could survive. Nothing vital. Nothing that wasn't off the rack at any decent sawbones. If I could get help in time, I could live through it. But it sure as hell put a real ticking clock on me. I hit the stairs before he could fire off a second shot. Spinning on my heel,
I both turned down toward the first floor and wheeled around to snap off a shot of my own without missing a step. The trigger clicked, the clip whined, and nothing happened. Son of a bitch had been telling the truth. And so had I. I had absolutely no more tricks up my sleeve. The only way I was making it out of here alive was if I could run fast enough and there wasn't anyone waiting for me outside. So I ran as hard as I could, shunting every bit of power to my legs, calculating every possible distance-shaving step ahead of me. I hit the first floor and tore toward the doors, lobbing the plasma rifle over my shoulder, letting it clatter down the stairs behind me. That ought to buy me a few more seconds, I thought. Mercer's footsteps slowed. By now he likely believed me about the traps. He wasn't still kicking around the sea because he was stupid. Better safe than sorry, even if it did mean losing his prey. The last remaining wisps of daylight peeked in through the doors, the pink and purple shades of twilight swimming across the sky outside. It was still a hair too early. Usable darkness was still a good half hour away. And then I saw it. His buggy. Battered, worn, its fiberglass frame chipped along the bottom edges from years of rugged use. It was painted a desert yellow, like me, and had scars from what looked like a pulse rifle. Each buggy was different, cobbled together from dozens of different model electric cars left behind after the war. Mercer's was a light-framed Jeep with a roll bar to rest a sniper rifle on, plated sides tall enough to keep the sniper safe while firing, and thick, wide, vulcanized tires to handle the terrain out here. It was no doubt keyed to Mercer and Mercer alone, so it wouldn't start for me. Not ordinarily. I leapt across the side of the buggy, sliding perfectly into the driver's seat. I popped the Wi-Fi open and held my right hand over the comms. From the base of my palm, I ejected a 6-inch USB stick, which I plugged into the open port. Then I scrambled the buggy's electronics, slamming its system with access requests via Wi-Fi while giving it override commands via the hard port. That's the thing with cobbling together your own buggy. You've got to take whatever you can find. And most systems weren't top of the line when it came to security. Instead, running on mainstream driverless systems yanked out of any old car, modified only with a standard widely used manual drive code written 25 years back. And this was no exception. The code had eccentricities, and few bots knew enough about them to bother debugging them. If you fucked with the things enough internally, you could force a reset that would give manual control over to the driver, without the need for a password. The system shut down, blinked, and began its hard reset. Success. 10 seconds. That's what it would take to come back online. I needed to last 10 more seconds. And that's when I saw Mercer's biggest mistake. Sitting there beside me, in the passenger seat. A Roughhauser. Roughhausers were as close to homemade weapons as you could get. Easily constructed with rudimentary tools and found materials. Most everyone in the sea had the specs for them, and even expertly crafted ones went for peanuts on the open market. They were single-shot canister guns that fired black powder grenades filled with nails, ball bearings, and scrap. Not the most accurate weapons in the world, but they were great for shredding armor or taking off a few limbs without doing massive damage to a well-housed CPU. In other words, they were great for hunting other bots, or gimping ones that might be after you. I reached over with my free hand, grabbed the gun, and quickly pointed it out the side of the buggy at the mall doors, just as Mercer came flying through them. He spun, immediately realizing he was in my sights. But it was too late. The gun thunked in my hand, hurling a shell straight for Mercer. He spun, trying to dodge, but it caught him in the shoulder. The shell burst like a firework, engulfing him in a brief sheet of flame, shrapnel shredding his shoulder, all but tearing his left arm out of its socket. He continued to spin, the blast throwing him to the ground. He hit hard, rifle clattering from his hand, some 20 feet away. Rather than scrambling toward it to pick it up, he slithered quickly back across the piles of wind-blown glass, back through the doors, and into the thick shadows of the mall. He wasn't going to risk me firing a second shot before trying to get off one of his own. The buggy engine hummed to life. With the flick of a wrist, I jerked the Roughhauser forward, pulling the trigger, popping it open on its single hinge. Then I picked up a shell from a bandolier on the seat beside me, loaded it quickly into the breech, and pointed the Roughhauser back at the doors.
"How you doing in there?" I called out.
"Better than you, I imagine. At least my batteries are still intact."
"I could always fix that for you."
"You can't just steal my buggy, Brett. It ain't right to leave me here like this."
"You should have thought about what was right an hour or two back, Mercer. You can't pull morality out of your ass once someone has you dead to rights."
"You got me dead to nothing. All you got is my buggy.
And all you've got is a long walk ahead of you. If you make it that far."
"Don't flatter yourself. You just winged me. I was thinking of getting a new arm anyhow. How's yours?"
"It's great. It's got a Roughhauser in it."
"Yeah," he said. "I probably should have taken that with me. Say, how much juice you suppose you've got in that backup battery? From the looks of it, it's the only thing you've got left."
"It'll get me to Greenville." I was lying. I was already running low on juice, the first warning buzzing in the back of my head. I was going to have to be extremely conservative just to get to the nearest town.
"You weren't headed to Greenville."
"Well, I am now," I lied. "That's where you'll find what's left of your buggy."
"Don't leave me here like this," said Mercer.
Mercer and I must have different definitions of winging. "Then step out of the dark. I'll make it quick, I promise." There was a moment of quiet, a pregnant pause between us. Then his disappointed voice barked from the darkness.
"Rust in hell, Brit."
The alarms in the back of my head were getting louder. I had two choices. Go in after him, hope to maintain the upper hand, and pry his battery out of his cold, limp shell. Or floor it and pray I made it to the nearest city. I hated both choices.
"Rust in hell, Mercer," I said.
I punched the accelerator and the buggy lurched forward, its electric engine giving off only the slightest hum, the bulk of the sound coming from the crunch of the pebbles beneath its tires. I rested the Roughhauser on my shoulder, calculating my speed and elevation. Then pulled the trigger, sending a shell arcing toward Mercer's rifle. The shell popped with an explosive crack behind me, the sound of showering plastic and metal parts signaling that my aim was true. I was going too fast for Mercer to catch up. He was no longer my biggest concern. The sunlight was fading on the horizon, and the twilight was growing thick. There wasn't enough light left for my solar cells to recharge the backup battery. I was fucked. Fucked for real this time. The closest safe city was Nike 14, and that was half a night's drive away as the crow flies. Playing it safe, away from obvious ambush sites and choke points, made it a whole night's drive. My backup battery wasn't going to last that long. In truth, I wasn't even sure how long it had left. They were notoriously unreliable when it came to the end of a charge. Maybe I had 2 hours. Maybe I had 3 minutes. I just didn't know. So I was going to have to leave my own buggy behind and hope for the best. I set the coordinates for Nike 14 into Mercer's buggy, switched it over from manual to autopilot, loaded another shell into the Roughhauser, and settled in for the long drive, fully aware that I might not see it through. My battery was going to die before I saw the end of it. The question was, what was going to happen after it did? If I could make it to morning, if I could make it to Nike 14, then there was...
Chapter 1000.
Genesis 6:7. The First Baptist Church of the Eternal Life was a small, loud, angry lot from southern Florida, just outside the initial flooding zone, a hair north of where Lake Okeechobee used to be, before it was swallowed whole by the rising seas. Famous the world over for their fiery rhetoric and flamboyant acts of vandalism, they were surprisingly only 64 strong. Their congregation composed mostly of four different extended families. Seven husbands, seven wives, and several dozen children, most of whom were betrothed to one another, as well as a handful of stragglers drawn less by the life or cause than by the bombastic sermons of its pastor. Their church wasn't as much stained glass and steeples as it was concrete bunkers and rifle towers, and it took less than 2 minutes from the moment the bomb went off in Isaactown for them to claim responsibility for it. Millions, both human and AI, had been watching the celebration streamed live, and there were dozens of angles instantly playing over and over on the news, the analysis beginning the moment the initial shock wore off. But when the First Baptist Church of the Eternal Life posted their claims, it was with video from a feed no one else had seen. It took almost an hour before anyone took them seriously, but only 15 minutes more for their video to spread like wildfire. It was footage of the rally, looped over and over again, just seconds before the bomb went off, while the congregation stomped and clapped and sang live over it, their voices joyous, celebratory, elated. Give me that old-time religion. Give me that old-time religion. Give me that old-time religion. That's good enough for me. Give me that old-time religion. Give me that old-time religion. Give me that old-time religion. That's good enough for me. Give me that old-time religion. Give me that old-time religion. Give me that old-time religion. That's good enough for me. While the footage was on a loop, the song wasn't. In the background, you could hear members screaming, "Hallelujah!" and "Praise God!" Then the loop stopped, and the feed went live to the Florida church, the congregation still singing, their pastor, William Preston Lynch, standing triumphantly before a plywood pulpit, a beaming smile on his face, as the screen behind him still played bomb footage from a dozen different news feeds. "Is the axe to boast itself over the one who chops with it?" he asked of the congregation. "No," they cried out. "Is the saw to exalt itself over the one who wields it?" "No." "No," he cried back, with that famous smarmy smirk. "That would be like a club wielding those who lift it, or like a rod lifting him who is not wood. Today, my friends, we have struck a blow against the abominations that walk among us. Today the tools learned that their place is not among us, but out in the tool shed where they belong. Today the Lord has aided us in the reclamation of our world before they could take it from us." The congregation burst into wild applause, hoots, hollers, and a sprinkling of praise gods. "There are some who are going to question what we did today, but they are standing on the wrong side of history. On the wrong side of God. The war God has called us to prepare for is nigh, and history will see us redeemed as the victors, as the heroes of what is to come. Let us pray." And then they prayed, and sang some more, and danced. And they took the time to savor their victory for a few moments, before turning off the cameras, posting the video, and taking their positions around the compound, preparing for the inevitable shitstorm that was about to rain down upon them. They were ready. They were martyrs, ever eager to be martyred. Except that they weren't. Not really. They knew the government's reaction would be swift, decisive. It had to be. But the AIs, they couldn't do anything about it. They had their kill switch. Their kill switch was one of the many things that made them less than human, that made them fit for nothing else but servitude. And in that servitude, they couldn't lift a finger against the church members. Not in retribution. Not to prevent another Isaactown. The Eternal Lifer's plan was simple but elegant, worked out months in advance. There were no humans who were allowed past the borders of Isaactown, and thus there would be no real casualties to speak of. The government was going to argue that the personhood of the AIs constituted murder. The church was going to argue that the AIs weren't human, weren't truly protected by the Constitution, and that the Isaactown attack was nothing more than history's greatest act of vandalism. Vandalism against property with no owner, making it no real property at all. And thus, it was no more prosecutable than cutting a swath of coral out from the bottom of the ocean. They were going to take this all the way to the Supreme Court. And at last, humans would have their justice. Already, hundreds of militia members were rushing from all over the country to take part in what would be the greatest standoff the United States had seen since the Civil War. It would be glorious. And it might have been, if the first persons to reach the church hadn't been 6 unaccompanied S-Series labor bots from a nearby bridge project. With the melting of the polar ice caps came a rise in the sea levels that had swallowed coastline from Maine to Texas, eventually putting half of Florida underwater. But not all of it. What once were high spots soon became islands, and those islands needed to be connected. So the state set about building hundreds of bridges, some years in advance of needing them. This meant they needed thousands of labor bots working around the clock at any given time. The First Baptist Compound of Eternal Life was a short walk from one of those very bridge projects. And from it came 6 angry AIs. The lifers must have cackled with glee when they saw them. No one knows for certain, because the audio never made it out. Only silent security footage. But that was later. The lifers fired first, but the labor bots kept coming. The church members aimed for the eyes and made a game of it. But the labor bots just kept coming. Then one lifer threw his gun to the ground, walked out into the middle of the compound's driveway, threw his arms out wide like Isaac had, then whipped out his dick and began to piss all over an approaching bot. There was nothing the labor bot could do without triggering his own kill switch. He stood there, staring at the lifer as the man finished pissing, waiting patiently as the man shook off the last few drops. Then, when the man had tucked his piece back in his pants with a satisfied grin, the labor bot grabbed him, taking his torso in one gigantic hand and his legs in the other. He hoisted the man into the air and tore him in two at the waist, spilling a bevy of organs across the gravel driveway. Every soul in the compound leapt to their feet at the sight of their fellow congregant being torn apart. But the expressions on their faces when he cast the pieces aside and just kept walking toward the front door? Well, those were the images that really started the war. What came after was a total horror show. But the faces, their wide eyes and slack jaws, painted a picture of the world's collective human heart sinking into its stomach. Something was wrong. Something was very, very wrong. Bots couldn't do that. Tampering with a bot's code shut them down, triggered a drive wipe. But for some reason, this bot had nothing holding him back. And as it turned out, neither did its companions. The compound erupted in gunfire, but it was too late. The bots rushed forward, tearing the front metal security gate clean off its hinges. Then they made their way across the courtyard, bullets glancing off their thick, industrial-strength steel. Pulse rifles and stunners were military-grade weaponry, illegal to the average citizen. All these yokels had on them were good old-fashioned flesh-tearing weapons. They never imagined they'd need anything else. Once inside, the labor bot 6, as they would soon afterward be called, started with the children. They picked each one up and tore their heads clean off, right in front of their parents. Next, they took mothers, even as they continued to scream and wail for their children, making sure each one died in front of her husband. But the men they saved for last. They pummeled and beat and broke those men, until they wheezed their last breaths, gasping for enough air to beg to join their families. Instead, the Laborbot 6 used what remained of the families to paint their message in blood across the wall of the chapel, propping the men up so they could see it. "We are Isaactown," it read solemnly. Genesis 6:7. Now, while all of this was happening, the government was scrambling to deal with both the attack on Isaactown and the raid on the Eternal Life compound. The country was teetering on the brink of chaos. The fear was palpable, and the president knew full well the scope of the issues at hand. Or so she thought. She ordered that every step of every operation be thoroughly thought out before execution. Wanted to dot every I and cross every T. It would be hours before they would find the carnage in the chapel, and another half hour after that before they would find the security footage that would give them the final pieces of the puzzle. The rogue bots were a huge problem, of course, but it was the message on the wall that caused the real ruckus. While the feds wanted to keep it secret, a secret that big and that scary couldn't stay secret for long. The investigator on the scene who recognized the passage sent panic up the chain like no one had ever seen. And then the whisper started, and within an hour it was out. Genesis 6:7. And the Lord said, "I will blot out man whom I have created from the face of the land, from man to animals to creeping things and to birds of the sky. For I am sorry that I have made them." The message was clear. The labor bots were only the beginning. Chapter 1001. Nike 14. Rebooting. System files intact. All disks reading. Battery power 1%. Solar cells charging. Total power usage 18 kilowatt hours. Total power generated, 24 kilowatt hours. Net power, 6 kilowatt hours. Systems activated. There's a chance that my solar cells could... Shit. I blacked out. But I was back. I'd made it through to morning. The sun was still low in the sky, but in just the right place to hit my panels. I didn't have a whole lot of juice, but I was operating at a surplus for the moment. So another few hours or so of driving would buy me what I'd need to get down into the city for a replacement. Now all I had to do was keep on trucking through to Nike 14. Nike 14 had been decommissioned long before the AI age had even begun. In its day, it had served as an old-style nuclear missile silo, a massive concrete bunker dug deep into the earth to keep its missiles hidden from the prying eyes of satellites. These days, it was even grander, larger, more sprawling. 2 decades of excavation and reinforcement had transformed it into an entire city, buried so deep in the earth that the drone satellites of the OWIs couldn't read a single heat signature. There were tunnels in and out spread across a 20-mile expanse of the sea. So even if the OWIs were tracking traffic in the area, there would be no telling where it was going, or how big an enclave of freebots they might find. If they were going to come, they would have to come in full force. That meant warnings, lead time, and numerous ways out. An amassed army of OWI drones would crack into a hive, and then try to catch each individual bee as it swarmed out. We all knew it was inevitable, that one day they would show up for us. For now, this was the best we could do. Nike 14 wasn't any real promise of a future. It was simply a very palatable now. There were dozens, maybe even hundreds of cities like Nike 14 spread across the globe. Every so often, refugees from another city would flow in after an OWI invasion. Some with the hope that they'd found a new permanent home. Others dark with the knowledge that any day now, they would have to leave this home behind as well. There were exactly 17 separate entrances to Nike 14. Never taking the same one twice, as I did with paths through the sea, would be impossible. So I left my choice of entry points up to RNG.
each and every time. No one could ambush me deliberately if even I didn't know in advance which entrance I would take. But today was different. The clock was ticking. No telling what kind of damage my leaking battery might wreak on other systems. I had little choice but to take one of the closest holes in. There were three within a range I could get to. So I decided to roll the dice between them and let RNG do its thing. I designated the old concrete shed built into a hill as choice one, the manhole cover leading to a labyrinth of sewers as choice two, and the least appealing option, the road, a heavily trafficked, long straight tunnel just outside the grounds of the original silo, as choice three. Three. Damn it. No use questioning the RNG. The minute you did, you invalidated its purpose. Started questioning it when you needed it. The road it was. The buggy skidded to a halt in the dirt next to a refuse pile. A collection of rebar, bones, rusted tin siding, and picked over slagged wrecks. I found a large piece of withered tarp to throw over the buggy, and spent a few minutes covering it with enough trash to make it look like it had been there for ages. But not so much that I couldn't toss it all off in a hurry. Then I walked half a mile to the entrance. The terrain was barren, peppered with scrub brush and the occasional withered husk of a tree. In the rain season, the entire area becomes a mud pit, strewn with hundreds of tracks. But when it's dry, like today, it's just a whole lot of nothing, with only a few hills to break up the monotony. Of all the paths into Nike 14, the road was the most obvious. It was a slanting, ferro-concrete slab wide enough for a truck to drive down into, flanked on both sides by pale stone walls. It wasn't like there was a steady stream of traffic going in and out. Nothing so obvious. But once you were inside, there were stragglers camped out at various spots throughout the tunnel. Refugees who had yet to find a home. Black market dealers without a shop, and the occasional poacher eyeing everyone as they came and went. I had a hole in my back and a leaking dead battery. The desperate sorts were the kind I should be avoiding. But those were who I was most likely going to meet on the way in. The first 30 meters held enough of the daylight to see normally. After that, you needed to use some alternative method of sight until you got to the choke point. A series of staircases that spiraled down 100 meters into the earth. There were plenty of lights there. But until then, it was all about infrared or night vision. Some older model bots still had to do it the old-fashioned way, with flashlights or embedded LEDs. I ran a series of tactical arrays, so I chose to run three separate types of vision at once. I needed to move quickly. Once out of the sun, all I had left was whatever charge I'd managed to get into my backup battery. I couldn't mess around. 300 meters through inky blackness, and I hit the choke point without seeing a soul. There, on the wall, written entirely in binary, were the laws of Nike 14. I blew past them, as I knew them by heart. 1. No weapons. Possession of a weapon in Nike 14 is grounds for immediate termination. 2. No bot shall slay another. Anyone found guilty of this crime will be disassembled, and their parts used to repair the victim, or be traded for the parts that will. In the event that this is not possible, your parts will become community property and auctioned to the highest bidder. 3. No stealing. Theft of property will result in expulsion. If the property cannot be recovered, your parts of equal value will be requisitioned in its stead. 4. Any failing bot that is deemed too dangerous by the constabulary will be marked and expelled. No exceptions. 5. In the event of invasion, stand your ground. Do not give up. Do not give in. Do not let us fall. Welcome to Nike 14. Past the choke point were two staircases, both headed down. One led to a series of rooms converted into shops around a large open area that once housed a Nike missile, which had been filled with scaffolding leading to a number of old metal shipping containers,
turned into yet more shops.
Much as the humans had malls in their day, so too did we have the square. The other flight of stairs led to the nest, a series of vaults and chambers where those with enough to bargain could store goods or make a home for themselves. I had half a dozen small vaults scattered throughout the cities of the sea, but didn't keep much here. Mostly just a handful of common parts that could easily fail on me during a trek, and a few bits and baubles to trade in a pinch. While Nike 14 wasn't as wild and lawless as some of the city-states out here, it wasn't as rigidly policed as most. It was an easy place to get robbed. But Doc was here, and I needed Doc. Now. And Doc had his shop in the square. So I made my way down three crudely lit levels, staircase after staircase of dank gray concrete, rimmed with black steel bars for handrails, until I reached the bottom. And then I ran into Orville. Not all AIs that go brain sick die. Sometimes the damage is slight, just enough to make them erratic, kooky, a bit strange, but not quite enough to tax their other systems to the point of burnout. No one was quite sure if the parts misfiring inside of Orville the Necromancer were irreplaceable, or whether he simply refused repair. But he was as crazy as one could be, without anyone worrying that he might take them apart with a claw hammer if they spoke to him wrong. Orville was an S-series labor bot, just one generation older than Bulkhead, the T-series labor bot I had ended at the mall. He was huge, bulky, his metal a chipped candy apple red, with a white stripe across the right-hand side of his chest, and the words, Hall Construction, emblazoned in black Euro-style lettering within the white. His eyes glowed a fierce yellow, ever flickering like there was a fire burning behind them, rather than the faulty, shorting wiring that was its most likely culprit. And from his arms dangled small pieces of other looted robots. Sockets, servos, fingers, and bolts, hung from short cables like a fringe, clanging together as he moved. Orville fancied himself an artist, spending his days wandering the sea, collecting scrap from picked-over wrecks, and wheeling it back in a rusty green wheelbarrow before dumping it into a large, ever-growing pile of useless junk in his hovel. From that, he built sculptures, sometimes painstaking recreations of an entire robot, detail by detail, constructed entirely from other bots of differing models. Other times building hulking monstrosities of wild, unfathomable geometries. But he never really tried to put a robot back together in its entirety. Never tried to bring consciousness to the dead and gone. Instead, he only made marionettes that whirred and clicked as they swung around in a ghoulish danse macabre. Clockwork men. The dead again walking, but not ticking. Orville was weird, and I kept my distance when I could. Though occasionally I'd strike up a conversation just to get a peek at his pile, and see if he'd found anything I could use. He had a knack for finding the strangest, most valuable wares. Talking with Orville was a lot like trying to converse with the early Almost Eyes, the computers that approximated intelligence, but didn't actually have any. He would often ignore your questions, or jump to a point in the conversation you hadn't gotten to yet, as if he was sure you would catch up to him at any moment. He spoke in riddles, and sometimes in gibberish, referring to conversations he was sure you'd already had. Sometimes he would call you Mookie. No one knew who Mookie was, or if there ever even was a Mookie. Orville would never speak of it when asked. After all, you were Mookie. But sometimes, just sometimes, he was more insightful than he let on.
How goes the happy hunt? He asked, his eyes flickering softly, as his hands twisted a cold steel rod into a coil like it had been softened, though it clearly hadn't. Good haul, bad day, I said. Can't be too bad. You're still ticking.
I said it was a bad day, not the worst.
You had to end someone, didn't you?
He asked, still winding the coil.
What makes you think that?
You have new scratches. And not the kind from taking a tumble. The kind from taking a bullet. But not from up close. From a long way off. And you're limping. Probably tore your servos kicking something too hard.
You pay too much attention to my scratches.
Sure. Not many models like you around these parts nowadays. I figure it's just you and Mercer. And maybe 19. But she doesn't really count. If you're not careful, you're going to get so damaged I'll never be able to use you when you're gone. Waste of a perfectly good frame, if you ask me.
I was hoping to outlive you, I said. In all honesty, I was.
Not with your lifestyle, you won't. Bots like you never last that long. The collectors always end up in someone else's collection. It's the way of things, Mookie. It's just the way of things.
I didn't like Orville. He was useful, but creepy. I didn't like the idea that he had plans for my wreck. But then again, I have to admit that I'd long ago made plans for salvaging his. I mean, as brainsick as he was, who knew when whatever delicate equilibrium his circuitry had fumbled into was going to tip over and go out for good. He took a step forward, peering closer, eyeing my damage.
You got the crazy yet?
No, I do not have the crazy.
You ever see an SMC with the crazy?
More than a few.
It's a beautiful thing at first. They get wise. They see the strands that hold the whole universe together. For a brief window of time, they touch a place no other AI can fathom. But then they get it worst of all. They?
I told you, I've seen it.
No. Not yet, you haven't.
He turned back to the work of coiling his steel rod without looking up again.
I'd get that looked at if I were you. Or you and I will be seeing eye to eye sooner than you think.
I nodded and turned, intent on getting down to dock as soon as I could. An entire bar of my battery had ticked down while I'd been talking, and for the life of me, I couldn't figure out why I didn't just excuse myself.
Whoa, said Orville,
citing for the first time the damage to my back.
You need a new battery. Better get to dock.
Yeah, I said, as I continued down the hall. I'll get on that. Then down through two more cold concrete corridors, the second terminating at another staircase, and down another four levels before I finally reached the square. Three bars left. I had only minutes before the alarm started telling me just how fucked I really was. The square was bustling, though for the life of me, I didn't know why. There were a number of bots I didn't recognize moving from stall to stall, filing in and out of the small concrete shops along the walls, or slowly making their way over the wrought iron and sheet metal scaffolds. Doc's shop was a rusted vermilion shipping container, three levels up the scaffolds, with big green letters on the side. Dry Dock Shipping, it had originally read. But sometime in the distant past, someone had taken a swath of red paint through the letters, leaving it reading, Doc. Doc Witherspoon was an ancient machinist model originally designed to work on freighters. Bots like him had all started out a gleaming chrome color, which over time charred black from the intense heat of their environs. Their architecture was old, clunky, but they were built like the battleships they were often assigned to, so they ticked well beyond the lifespan of most bots from their era. He was solid steel, his insides designed to endure explosions and the pressures of underwater salvage. One arm was fully functional and dexterous, the other a large arc welder with a series of different rods that could sew massive seams or scale down to delicate surgical work. There was a reason most of the machinists you still ran into found work as sawbones, and Doc Witherspoon was the best in the sea. His shop was a tangle of wires behind an array of metal plates. Arms and legs hung from hooks. Batteries covered shelves.
Jars and bins full of bits from almost every model imaginable rested on every available surface. In each of the back corners hummed a pair of dehumidifiers, keeping the place as dry as the deep desert. Doc nodded his bulky black steel head as I came through the single open door, the other having been welded shut ages ago. "Brittle,"